Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wayne White, who is a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle Eastern countries, in particular Iran and Iraq. He is a policy expert at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia and was Senior Regional Analyst from 2002 to 2005. And the State Department's intelligence briefer on Iran and Iraq for the Cooperation Council of the Arab States of the Gulf. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne White.
My pleasure, Ian.
And you were a part of the only intelligence bureau of the 16 in the alphabet soup there in Washington that didn't roll over for the Bush administration in terms of telling the truth about Iraq and the WMDs. Given that the United States is now folding the flag and it will be out by the end of this month, of course, the Iraqi Prime Minister Maliki is in a meeting at the White House as well. This feels like a moment to reflect. As one who's been deeply involved in Iraq and Iran, for that matter, for a long time, what's your dominant feelings at this point?
Well, I'm relieved that we're leaving, that our troops are getting out. I can't deny that because we're still losing people in Iraq, even though Afghanistan has taken the front page. But on the other hand, we're leaving by a vulnerable embassy, which would be very large, in the former Green Zone of Baghdad. And there'll be several hundred troops attached to that for its defense. But if any serious problems develop, that might not be enough. And I'm still personally just devastated over what happened in Iraq while we were there. And the very thought of talking about Iraq as a success, as so many are wont to do right now, is just simply out of place.
So would you say that the Iraqis are worse off today than they were under Saddam Hussein?
You know, this is something that a lot of people would say is politically incorrect, because, of course, there were arrests and there were killings and things going on. But one thing we have to forget is for people who never lived in Iraq under Saddam Hussein was that some of the real horrors you hear about, like the genocide against the Kurds, the draining of the southern marshes, and genocide against the Shia down there, they were compressed into very narrow bands of years. And there were many years in which, although there were hundreds of arrests and surely there were killings, the country did not reach anything like the bloodletting that happened after we came into Iraq. Tens of thousands of Iraqis died as a result of our war. And then came the struggle against the insurgency, in which tens of thousands of Iraqis died there. And then finally, the thing that propelled us into making a deal with the insurgents, which is often just called the surge, the deal that really dealt the Sunni insurgents off the table and took away about 90% of the opposition, not so much the surge, which was not significant. Until that happened, over 100,000 Shia and Sunni had killed each other in a horrible sectarian bloodletting that also displaced millions of Iraqis and changed the complete character of Baghdad. And so it's hard to look back at what the Iraqis have been through and say that that was a success.
So, Wayne White, obviously the invasion itself changed that equation. And there were some people like Brent Scowcroft who tried to warn President Bush, and for some reason or other, Bush's own father did not intervene or didn't step up, even though his own national security advisor said that this will be a disaster and it'll only empower Iran, which it clearly has done. But now we do have a Cold War with Iran, and the Defense Authorization Act that is the president's threatening to veto would up the ante on Iran, cutting off their ability to sell oil, which could provoke them. They already have shown signs of irrational behavior with the sacking of the British embassy. In this context, do you think that it would be possible, for example, for an Iranian-backed militia in Iraq, when the Americans have gone, to go after the Green Zone or the U.S. consulate in Basra?
I think that this is something we should very seriously contemplate if we make the severe mistake of taking military action against Iran, or if we in any way encourage Israel to do the same, because for many Iranians, particularly in the clerical dominated government there, which is intensely anti-American, there's little difference between the two. And more, my main fear is if Iran gets hit militarily, she will not do those things now, but she will put those things very much on her contingency hit list for retaliation if she is attacked.
So given that Iran is a paranoid regime and it looks like they're in the process of losing a foreign policy success, if you will, with their relationship with Syria. Now, apparently the president and Maliki talked about this today, that Obama wanted Maliki to put more pressure on Syria's Assad to step down. What's your sense of where things are heading in that neighborhood? Who's up and who's down?
Well, Assad is the Assad family and their supporters in Syria are in very grave trouble. But the fact is that the Iranians have leaned hard on Maliki not to join with the rest of the Arab League in going along with supporting the ouster of Bashar al-Assad. And here's another one of these ironies when we talk about Saddam and that era being so awful, and I don't want to deny it was. It was. But Saddam absolutely despised the Assads, and they him. And he would have been delighted to participate in anything, even covert action, to get rid of the Assads. And so here we are again, replacing a regime that actually in some ways acted in ways that were not inconsistent with American interests at times, with one that now is under this, more under the sway of Iran, something absolutely anathema to Saddam, and therefore crossing us with respect to our interests in the region.
So, Wainwright, this is a country that's been ravaged. Its infrastructure was destroyed in two wars, but really destroyed in the second one. And then the U.S. had a long military engagement there that resulted in the deaths, which nobody quite knows the figures. Hundreds of thousands, I guess, is a safe bet. It seems to be a country of widows. All of the Christians have been driven out by sectarian violence, and they tended to be a something of a technological elite there. And you've got the Kurds going their own way with the oil and trying to have as little to do with the central government as possible.
Another region's thinking of doing likewise.
Which other regions are that?
Basra is very interested in taking off on any concessions given to the Kurds by demanding its own autonomous control over the massive oil fields in the extreme south.
Hmm. So this is a broken country, and we broke it. Wasn't that what Colin Powell warned George W. Bush? You know, the pottery barn adage, if you break it, you own it. Well, now we're disowning it, right?
Essentially. In fact, the Iraqi military is protesting loudly that it's really not capable of defending its borders, either in terms of ground forces, who are mainly without tanks and heavy equipment owned by all of its potential adversaries, its airspace, because it has yet to receive any modern fighter jets, and when it starts receiving them next year and the year after, they'll be in small quantities, not anything like the hundreds possessed by opponents. And their training will lag very, very seriously. And in fact, we just had an announcement, I believe it was earlier today, where NATO is pulling out a training mission that was very heavily supplementing our own, which isn't talked about very much, in which over 100 NATO advisors are leaving with us. Who were training over 5,000 Iraqi troops as part of this program because they also could not get immunity.
Well, I think we're selling something like 16 or 18 F-16s, right?
That's right, in the first tranche. But that's peanuts compared to what countries like Saudi Arabia have. We're talking in terms of Saudi Arabia in modern U.S. and NATO jets, mainly British. We're talking over 400 aircraft. And so Iraq's not, for years, is not even going to be in the same league.
Well, doesn't this sort of indicate further the extent to which Iran was the winner of the Iraq War?
Oh, yes. And then the lack of clout, the lack of military clout that Iraq has now makes it vulnerable. And its premier enemy always has been Iran. And so Iran will, therefore, have quite a lot of influence. And in addition, its internal situation continues to roil, pitting Sunni and Kurd against Shia and Kurd against both Arab Sunnis and Shia. And in this environment, the Iranians will prosper as the defenders of Shia rights, aiding the Shia in any dust-up with the Sunnis. And actually, the Iranians, smart as they are, have their money on both sides of the account in Kurdistan. Jalal Talabani's Kurdistan operation is heavily linked to the Iranians, and he also happens to be in a position of power in Baghdad, and the Iranians have a big, huge bet there as well. And so they're pulling the strings behind the scenes on a lot of Iraqi issues, and the country has so many unresolved internal issues that the Iranians will be able to do this for quite some time.
So what's your sense, Wayne White? Again, Wayne White's an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group, previously served as the deputy director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia, and is a specialist on both Iraq and Iran. What is your sense, then, of the U.S.'s ability to hold on to this this Hezbollah prisoner that they have, this Lebanese fellow that's killed some Americans? I mean, we know that, for example, the Shiite health minister who was running a death squad is elected to the parliament, and he's immune. It feels like the U.S. is kind of impotent here in terms of getting people that killed Americans.
It is, and that is may have a lot more importance in what we've been talking about beyond where this individual, Doc Duke, ends up, because we still hold him. And we're negotiating with the Iraqis to take him with us. The Iraqis are considering this. But if they say no, and we violate that and take him with us, it'll just lower our standing substantially further in a country that's already angered over a number of issues related to the United States. Remember, we are filled with a country here in which there are millions of people who have no homes because of us. We have vast numbers of Sunni Arabs who were displaced from Baghdad during the sectarian strife. They're still gone. In fact, hundreds of thousands of them are still stuck in Syria, which is, you know, edging towards civil war. And so this could undermine us even further if we opt, in this case, with this one man to preempt the situation and just sort of scuttle away with him.
So what do you think is the reason why the architects of this Iraq war have not been held to account? I was watching a Republican debate the other day, and the question is, it was hosted by the American Enterprise Institute and the Heritage Foundation. And then, so not surprisingly, the questioners were literally the whole pantheon of the neoconservatives, architects of this war, Wolfowitz, Addington, et cetera. And you get the feeling that reality is not impinging on them. I mean, the founder of the neoconservative movement, Irving Kristol, said that neoconservatives are liberals who have been mugged by reality. Well, reality has mugged the neoconservatives big time over their Iraq misadventure, but there seems to be no contrition, not even admission of failure.
Absolutely. There are several explanations for this, but one is the continued drumfire of propaganda emanating from the right and even from some of the more conservative elements in the Democratic Party, that because violence is way down, and despite the fact that most everything else in Iraq remains unsolved and the power's off in most areas and et cetera, and civil services are an absolute appalling disgrace compared with the Saddamist era, that we've won, or it's been successful just because violence is down, forgetting the fact that we were the ones who created the situation that took it up in the first place. The average American doesn't understand the issues, and therefore they just hear violence has gone down, and that's good, and therefore it must be success. The other thing we have going on is immense propaganda on the right, working on their own base to characterize Iraq again as a success. I mean, you know, the Fox News bit and all that that goes on day after day after day, and that's what people want to believe. My average American doesn't want to believe that there's been a failure. They want to believe it's a success. The final factor is they very cleverly, many of the people advocating the success fiction, as I'd like to call it, are those who have successfully linked supporting our troops with saying that Iraq was a success. In other words, if you say it was a failure, we didn't achieve our goals, then all our troops died, that were perished there, sadly, perished in vain, and you get into that dynamic where it's just politically incorrect to go in that direction. So there's a lot of things at work, very successfully exploited by the right in order to characterize Iraq as something it isn't.
Well, so just in closing, then, Wayne White, one wonders whether there will be an accounting. I mean, what seems to be the legacy of Iraq is not what the neoconservatives are saying, which is, toppling Saddam Hussein led directly to the Arab Spring, which seems to be such a nonsensical reach, it's barely worth discussing. But what clearly has happened is this has brought about a Sunni-Shia civil war. When you have Israel and Saudi Arabia on the same page wanting the U.S. to attack Iran, something's changed in that neighborhood.
Well, one of the ironies might be in that the Iraqi government is so appallingly corrupt, utterly dysfunctional, and to the extent there might be strife that could follow in the wake of our withdrawal over the years, it might not break out immediately, we could see an Arab Spring break out in Iraq. And then we'd see the Maliki government either having to succumb to it or brutally repress it. And so people who say that we started the Arab Spring by going into Iraq have created one of the most dysfunctional, corrupt, and in some cases despotic governments in the region. You know, there are secret police nodes that answer directly to the prime minister, secret prisons going on right now, and whatnot, that we might see an Arab Spring reverberate into Iraq, not from it, in the coming years, if things don't change, and I don't see them changing.
Well, there was some recent demonstrations along those lines, people demanding justice and transparency and honesty and the end of corruption, and they got brutally treated.
Exactly. They just weren't large. But if they got large, you could see a very different and more noticeable effect that the international community wouldn't be able to ignore as much as it did, because they occurred at a time when there were other things happening in the other countries affected by the Arab Spring, which drew a lot more attention because of the numbers.
So the real legacy is that we've opened up this can of worms now that has made a war with Iran, as crazy as it is, more likely.
In a way, it could be more likely, because in other words, to the extent Iran interferes in Iraq, which ironically is a result of us going into Iraq, therefore gives those advocating a war against a strike against Iraq to Iran to bring down its strategic power the right to blame that on Iran too, and therefore add to the reasons for why there should be a strike against Iran. Complete circular reasoning.
Well, I'm grateful that you could join us here today, Wayne White, and to reflect on what's not being said about Iraq on this occasion of Iraq's Prime Minister's visit to the White House.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne White, who's a scholar at the Middle East Institute, specializing in a number of Middle East countries, in particular Iran and Iraq. He's a policy advisor at the Middle East Policy Council and an expert advisor to the Iraq Study Group. He previously served as Deputy Director of the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research's Office of Analysis for the Near East and South Asia and was Senior Regional Analyst from 2002 to 2005 and was a State Department's Intelligence Briefer on Iran and Iraq for the Cooperation Council of the Arab States of the Gulf. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how the UK appears to have made itself irrelevant in Europe.
The new boy, the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a trier, an articulate liar. The auctioneer makes it clear.